Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is AB Dawji. And this is, of course, the Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. Ahlan wa sahlan. And how's it from Durban and all? The best place in the world. I beg your pardon? Joburg is better? Don't make me laugh, okay? What a lousy place. There's highways and buildings, no scenery whatsoever, except maybe that sad old Zoo Lake and some dams where you catch some hell of a weird-looking fish, eh? And the cold, ish, don't talk. I spent 5 years in that lousy Actonville. Anyway, let me, in this time of peace and goodwill, not be so negative about Joburg, okay? I'm sure that Johannesburg has many, many good points. For example, let's move on to Ramadan and Eid. So yes, it was different with the COVID cloud hanging over our heads, especially Eid, I suppose. Eh? The wear the mask, don't wear a mask issue at the Eidgah, and people being a bit nervous at family get-togethers and so on. I've heard a lot of people expressing some apprehension and so on. And you fatties, did the non-stop eating start after Eid Salah until just before you hit the bed late in the evening? Ach, shame, eh? Never mind. It's okay to overindulge once a year. Remember that? Once a year. Tomorrow, moderation. And still on the subject of Ramadan, I met Ravi at the car park of the supermarket. I can't remember how I know him. I knew him for a long time. I don't know how I met him. But he is quite a character, very chilled and quite funny. He said, "Hey, AB, where's my plate of sweetmeats, man?" I said, "Hey, don't tell me you didn't get it. I posted it last week. Maybe the O's at the post office chowed it." We laughed and chatted for a while. But he asked me something quite interesting. He said, "Bro, why you people don't eat whole month, no water, nothing? Why God torturing you so much?" I asked my neighbor, Uncle Suli, and he's a teacher. He said that you fast in Ramzan because it's spiritually uplifting. Hell, I don't know what that means, but I can tell you, when I have my cane and brandy, I feel very uplifted. So why don't you all eat? And also, why that man shouts from the mosque for you to come to pray five times a day? Eh? Serious, bro. I asked some of my slum friends and I still don't understand. Well, I was in a bit of a hurry, but this was a challenge I'm happy not to ignore. So I said, "Ravi, let me explain. You know, you go to the gym once a week, right? So after you come out, you feel all nice and energetic and fit and agile. Then by the time the end of the week comes, your battery starts getting flat. You're not so energetic until you get back to the exercise. Let me give you another example. You're driving to Joburg, so around halfway you have to fill up again. Otherwise, you may get stuck. But you know what? I got a better one for you. People are taking the vaccine shot, and then with some vaccines, another vaccine shot has to be taken. Right, so another vaccine shot has to be taken. I just got distracted there for a minute. So, after about 2 or 3 months, you have to take another, what is called a booster shot. And Ravi said, "Yeah, like when I go to the pub, I first have a shot of whiskey and after the second one, I feel lekker and like boosted." I'm just joking, carry on. I don't know this character. And I said, "So, bro, early in the morning, just before sunrise, we wake up and pray. After praying, we are filled with good, pious thinking, good religious thoughts, positive things that God teaches. And again, at lunchtime, we, we take a booster shot, we pray to keep us filled in positive things in dealing with people around us. Nothing negative, no cheating, no fighting, bad words, crookery, and so on. So 5 times a day, we give ourselves a booster to keep evil out of our minds. You can take each prayer like a vaccination that lasts until the next one." And Ravi said, "Hell, AB, I'm starting to understand, but why no eating for 1 month? That's a killer." I said, "Yeah, Ravi, it can be tough, especially when it's very hot. And sometimes when we are fasting in summer, the days can be long, but we are used to it. But it's similar to getting the booster five times a day, every day while we pray. During the year, people do whatever they like, whatever they feel. They feel hungry, they just chow, they talk anyhow, do whatever they like. So Ramadan is 1 month in the year when you discipline yourself, you train yourself. Same as I told you when you go to the gym, you strengthen yourself. This is the same sort of exercise, an exercise in self-control, my bro. Not only must you stop eating and drinking from sunrise to sunset, not only must nothing pass into your lips, but nothing bad must come out of your mouth also. No gossiping, no bad words, no swearing, no angry outbursts, nothing evil or negative. You have to control your words, self-discipline, and you have to spend as much time as possible praying. And you see lots of cars at the mosque in the evening. I'm sure you've seen it outside the mosque near your place. So, Ravi, just like you spend 3 hours at the gym strengthening your body, we spend 30 days in exercising self-control so that we strengthen our minds. And guess what? Even our bodies get strengthened. Medical science shows proof that fasting is very good for the body. It cleanses the body of all kinds of toxins, poisons and all that. It improves your cholesterol and blood pressure and many things. Well, Ravi was listening with his jaw dropping a little bit, right, very attentively. And I had to end right there because the fro phoned for the sour milk for the biryani. Ravi took my number and he said he's going to have more consultations, inshallah. Anyway, I always say that we should reach people who are not Muslims with a simple, practical message that they can easily relate to. Maybe I'll explain on that topic another time. But now, the subject that has its knee on my neck, that I can hardly breathe, is what's happening to our people in Palestine. But before we talk about Palestine itself, we need to cross over to Ibrahim Musa, who is outside the Israeli embassy in Pretoria. Ibrahim Musa, are you online? Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Abi, jazakallah khair and good speaking to you. Yes, indeed.
Right. Briefly, can you tell us what's happening out there?
Abi, there is obviously a protest that has been convened in the light of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip in different areas of Palestine, and also coinciding with a series of activities happening all across South Africa and Johannesburg, particularly today to mark Nakba Day. So a sizable spirited crowd, very huge Palestinian flags fluttering all around. It's convened by the South African BDS coalition and going through the motions of different speeches and chants until this point in time.
Right, and the mood of the people?
The mood is one of assertiveness today, I would say, maybe coming straight after the month of Ramadan, coming on the wake of the constant stream of footage and reports that are coming from the Gaza Strip in recent days, and a very assertive support, especially from the crowd, not so much from the stage, of the elements of the Palestinian resistance. And from the stage itself, a lot of focus on, from the side of the South African BDS coalition, on the fact that we're having this protest outside an Israeli embassy. That in itself should be cause for reflection in a democratic South Africa. So calls on the South African government to come through and come to the party or its long-held promises to act on this matter, and why is there Israeli ambassador in South Africa, why there is Israeli embassy in South Africa. More than that, you also have the call of visa-free travel for Palestinians, something that is allowed for Israelis to South Africa but not Palestinians. And after that, also, how do people continue beyond the protest, the reiterating the call for BDS as well as the boycott of things like clover in South Africa to become part of the wider structures.
Have any officials come out to meet you?
I don't think there's an expectation maybe for anybody to come. There's the Israeli embassy in Pretoria is away from many other embassies which are openly on street level. This is nestled within a security complex, a compound, so you don't have direct access to start off with, to the Israeli embassy, just in the closest point you could get to the Israeli embassy. No sign of officials, no sign of anybody from the Israeli embassy, and they just protected by a huge wall of Tshwane Metro Police, who are just watching it, watching the protest, but also in a kind of non-aggressive way, just standing in the position and observing the protest. And I think perhaps added to that, no expectation of receiving anybody would be the fact that it's the Sabbath as well.
All right, and finally, are there any prominent officials from political parties there?
Not at all. Probably, obviously, there would be certain individuals from the BDS coalition who would represent certain of those political parties, but I don't see anyone prominent, and perhaps it's a positive thing that no particular one political party is trying to jump onto the bandwagon to use the Palestinian cause to be able to forward their own political fortunes. In fact, many of the calls from the stage have been critical of the government, and also as we've seen obviously in protests of this kind over decades, almost two decades in South Africa, criticism of neoliberal policies of the government, support for the Sheikh dwellers and the like, etc. So I would say yes, no official government officials, and positive in the sense that it's not being hijacked to direct it in a certain direction.
Ibrahim Musa, jazakallah khair for that report from outside the Israeli embassy in Pretoria, and hope you have a successful day today, inshallah.
Barakallah, thank you so much. Jazakallah khair.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Right, so from Ibrahim Musa, we now cross over to a very important guest we have online, and that is a good friend of mine, Reverend Ntutuko Nkosi. He is very outspoken, as you will hear in a minute. Reverend, are you online?
I am alive and in revolutionary spirit of a free Palestine in our lifetime.
Assalamu alaikum, Habibi.
Habibi, kif halak, Habibi?
Alhamdulillah, kulur tamam, Habibi.
I've been missing you and your listeners, and you play a very important role in the public space and in solidarity with the afflicted, especially with Palestine. So I'm glad for you to have me today, my friend.
I am privileged to have you. Okay, let's get to the chase, cut to the chase, and tell us about your experience with Palestine. You've been there to Palestine. Give us a background around that.
In fact, I always tell people that there's a difference between visiting Palestine and actually living in Palestine, because of the tourism industry in that space. And people, they just go and see few places that they are shown by tour guides, and they conclude that they know about Israel, and they conclude that they know about Palestine, but they've never actually lived there. I lived there from 2014 to 2015 in a program, in a World Council of Churches program called the EAPTI, and I went back again in 2016. In 2014 to 2015, I was living in Jerusalem. In fact, Sheikh Jarrah, the community that is being displaced currently, was one of my major priorities that was assigned to me. So I've attended court cases of the community members of Sheikh Jarrah. I know the context very well, what they are going through, because that's what I was doing when I was there, 2014 to 2015. Then I went back in 2016. I was placed in the Jordan Valley in Jericho. I stayed in Jericho, and I did experience occupation and living with the Palestinians, waking up every day and conversing with them in their shop, meeting them in public spaces, and really having a fellowship. So Palestinian people, these people are ordinary people with something special in their hearts. They're so hospitable, I was the only black person in the community, but I did not feel any other way one would feel in other countries. But I was really treated special, and mostly because I'm from South Africa, and they really connect with our South African struggle. So Palestinian people are good people. They are going to face more than 34 occupations in the history. This is not the first occupation. You go back through to the Ottoman. You can go back to the Greeks. You can go back as far as the Babylonian Empire. So these are resolute people, if I may say. They're very strong people, very loving and cultured people. So they are human beings, man, just like all of us. And spending time with them, for me, was a great thing. But these people are going through occupation, Israeli occupation, a cruel occupation. They are being displaced. They are being disarmed. They are being crushed. They are being racially profiled. Every systematic prejudice you can think they are going through. And yet they are solid, a united nation and a united people. They're loving, they're supporting one another. So there are differences in two kinds, religiously wise. We're having the larger group, which is Muslims, and we have the group, a smaller group, which is Christians. And throughout their struggles, they've never fought their struggles as Muslims and Christians. Their struggles are intertwined, they are one. When I was there in 2014, they closed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they denied believers to go pray on Friday. And the first people who wrote statements, who were calling upon government, who were shouting on top of their voices, were Christians. And when we were blocked from going to Bethlehem during Christmas, the first people who shouted and on top of their voices were Muslims. So the occupation knows no religion. Occupation, as long as you are Palestinian, Arab, and you will suffer occupation. So yeah, these are Palestinians, and yeah.
What an excellent perspective there, Reverend. You are listening to Reverend Tutuko Nkosi, speaking to us from Ladysmith, is that right?
Yeah, in Escort.
In Escort, right. Okay, so, you know, there are similarities drawn between what's happening in Palestine and apartheid South Africa. And two organizations came out, Human Rights Watch and also B'Tselem, saying that, yes, indeed, it is what the international definition of apartheid is all about. How would you compare the two places?
Yo, you know, let me start with a little narrative, just a short one. My grandmother used to tell us a family story on how we were forcibly removed from our land in Koningsberg in 1967 into the Bantustans, where they were placed just outside Newcastle. And I never believed, not that I never believed, I never understood, because I never lived in the era. But I remember the first case, I had to attend as part of my duties of monitoring human international law and international human rights. We were called into a community just outside Jerusalem called Siloam. When I arrived there, the first thing I laid my eyes upon, I saw this old woman who was crying while her house was being demolished. And now the picture is, there's IDF all over, soldiers all over, carrying rifles, and their bulldozers breaking down the house. And when I saw this woman wanted to go into the house while it was being broken down, and this old man was pulling her back. And my eyes landed on the farm just next to the gate on three kids. It was two boys and one girl. I'm assuming these were grandchildren. And in that scene, the family narrative just came back. The stories my grandmother used to tell us, how they were forcibly removed from their land. And I want to say there are so many similarities, and I agree, but there are similarities and more. Now, in those days of apartheid, remember, the level of technology was not where it is now. Now, the level of technology, there are drones. There are drones flying over Palestinian territories. There are flying checkpoints. There are chips in these Palestinian IDs. They know exactly how many Palestinians that have crossed the checkpoint and how many Palestinians that have not come back. If you have not come back and you're still on the Jerusalem side, your house will be demolished. You will be punished. The occupation system is more cruel than apartheid, you know. And although occupation manifests itself differently, as I've said when I began, the occupation you see in Jordan Valley is not similar as the occupation you see in Jerusalem. The same thing that happened in South Africa, the occupation, the apartheid you see in Soweto, in Sophia Town, in Johannesburg, where it is just on your face and very brutal, was a little bit different than apartheid you find in the farmland. But this kind of apartheid that we see, the Israeli apartheid, is based on one ethnic cleansing, making sure that there are no Arabs or Palestinians in Jerusalem. That E1 plan, ethnic cleansing, is a reality, friends. I don't want to lie to you. And that's what they are doing today. For me, it was not a surprise that at the most special day of our Muslim brothers and sisters, the cruel system will come and attack worshippers, unarmed worshippers, unarmed women, unarmed men, unarmed children who had come to worship God. It is cruel. It is inhumane. No one should be going through that. So it makes occupation more, because in churches are respected. The apartheid regime would not enter and break down the church. In fact, our freedom fighters would run into the church because the apartheid government and the soldiers would not come and kick down the doors and in search. They respected the church. But here is a new prototype of apartheid, the one that we've never heard of, the one that we've never seen. It is worse than any other form of prejudice you'll ever find. I walked through the streets. The difference between East Jerusalem, which is predominantly Palestinian, and West Jerusalem, which is Jewish. The air changes when you walk across, you know. So you could actually smell it. Forget the walls that you see. Forget the physical elements of checkpoints. Forget the air changes. It is so clean in the West Jerusalem. They've got the state-of-the-art technology. Everything is up to date. But the same square meter, if I may say, you just go across East Jerusalem where Palestinians are, and the people who are supposed to be taking care of the municipality needs, they're not doing it, and because it is Palestinian. So, yeah, it's worse. It's a worse form. It's an open-air prison, Bishop Tutu said. And you do feel like you are in an open-air prison. Once you're in, you are in. It feels like that. Even worse for young people who are exposed to technology now. They see the lifestyle they should be living. They see the kind of lifestyle they should be living via internet. They see the freedom. And now they are stuck in their home. And it's very painful to see. Even when you speak to them, they give you very painful stories. They know what they deserve, but they're being treated like animals. And it's very.
My brother, you paint such a brilliantly graphic picture of the suffering of the Palestinian people. Now, I have no problem with Jews as a people. I have no problem with Judaism. Of course, I have a problem with Zionism, and it was classified at one stage as racism. But all these things are being done in the name of God. Those settlers are out there saying this is our holy land, and therefore we have to claim it.
Sure. And that's the misfortune of everything. But we've been having other Orthodox Jews, another movement of Jewish people who are in solidarity with the struggle of Palestinians, and they call themselves, in fact, they called the leaders and the prime minister heretics, because all this is done in the name of God, and all this is done in the name of, they say, but not in our name, not in the name of Yahweh. And don't you remember that we were once sent into Babylon because we did not love our neighbor? Don't you remember that we were once punished by God because we could not keep his commands? And you can't even draw biblical narratives as a Christian that you can and support your hate of Palestinians just because the Bible says so, or just because the Torah says so. There is no book that promotes hate. There is no religious book that promotes hate. And it's unfortunate that we are living in those times. And yet again, for your listeners, there are types of settlers. There are economical settlers. They don't care about religion. They are taken all over the world just to come and work in the fields, just to come and make money for the state of Israel. And they are religious settlers. They are moved by religion. They've got no DNA connection with the land. And these are kind of settlers that you find in Hebron. In Hebron, it is like a cage. When you walk in the streets of Hebron, you actually walk in cages because of these kind of settlers, religious settlers. So we are finding ourselves in such a space, in such a world of fear, where biblical extremism or religious extremism, if I may say, is used. And even worse, I have to say, as a Christian, Christian Zionism, Christianity has been a vehicle of this hate. The American Christianity has been a vehicle of this Christian Zionism, where they bring fear, they want to build the third temple. No one will force the Messiah to come. There is no human being that will force the Messiah to come. The Messiah will come on his own time when the right time is. So whether they build the third temple, the Messiah won't come just because they built the third temple. The Messiah won't come just because they've eradicated the Al-Aqsa Mosque. He won't come just because they don't acknowledge the image of God in our brothers who are Palestinians and who are Muslims in Crete. So nothing will force the Messiah to come. And mind you, the Messiah will come for all these three religions. For Muslims, he will come. For Christians, he will come. And for the Jews, the Messiah will come. No one will force. There is no injustice that will happen to the people of God to force the Messiah to come. The Messiah will come when the time is right. So these are the things that we are watching and we are praying for. My nightmare is a day where there is no Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. My nightmare is a day where there is no Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. My nightmare is where there is no Western world for the Jews in Jerusalem. All these three religions, they belong there.
Wow, amazing. Powerful words there from Reverend Ntutuko Nkosi. Powerful words. Voice of reason, a voice of peace, a voice of justice. More power to you, my brother. More power to you, Habibi.
Shukran to you.
Jazakallah khair. Thank you, my brother. And hope to speak to you again. There's so much to discuss.
There is so much to discuss. And I just wish that we can be really radical with our stance and the move as a country. Let's completely shut down the Israeli embassy. In fact, the Arab countries, they are guilty as charged in the court of justice. Arab countries, they are guilty as charged for letting Palestine suffer. And we need to say that firmly. Yes, we see Israel, but the friends of Palestine, by creed, are guilty for allowing this to happen to Palestinians.
Indeed. Excellent way to end the show. My brother, take care and more power to your voice.
Thank you very much, and take care to you, my brother, and all your listeners. God bless you all.
And you too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you are, folks. Amazing, amazing. As I said, a graphic description. The man stayed there, and he was with the Palestinians, walking with them, talking to them, and we've got a first-hand account of the suffering of the Palestinian people. Right, but we're running out of time here, but let me tell you again what I said to you many times previously. One of the best and worst experiences I had was being in Iraq when George Bush was bombing the place. 33 of us, human shields, were there. You know, we separated the group, few stations and civilian serving structures like dams, water filtration plants, electricity, power stations, and so on. You've heard all this before. We're in the middle of a nightmare. One-ton bombs were falling all around. The ground shook like an earthquake. Buildings swayed and collapsed. Fires, huge fires burning all over. Ambulances screaming. We were screaming. It was a pure horror story, a really bad experience. So what was good about it? As I said before, being there gives you a first-hand feeling of terror, death, and destruction. You have to be there to know what it's like, and it stays with you. So when you watch TV, when you, dear listeners, watch TV and see bombs dropping and big fires, yes, you are horrified, of course, but the volume on your TV is reasonably low, and of course the ground doesn't shake, so it's something of a numbed experience, relatively speaking. When I see this, I feel the real horror of what the people are experiencing. I can feel it, and therefore I say it was good to be in Iraq, because I feel like I'm really in Gaza right now as the bombs drop. You get what I'm saying, eh? But in all of this horror, one aspect is not often focused on. It's not often focused on. We hear the latest figures, 130 dead, 30 of them children, 1,000 injured, cold hard figures. And of course, they're changing every day. Netanyahu killed 30 dangerous terrorists. One was 8 months old. One was still 8 months in his mother's stomach. Never got a chance to come out and immediately kill Israelis. Other terrorists were 2 years, 5 years, 8 years old, 12 years, 13 years old. Netanyahu and his mighty army made sure that they posed no danger to his country. And just last night, a bomb fell on a house and 8 people were killed, 6 of them dangerous terrorists under the age of 10. And so, dear listeners, as I said, we get all kinds of figures about how many killed, but we rarely hear about how many who are alive, mentally wounded, and here I'm particularly focusing on children. Gaza is about 42 kilometers long along the sea and about 5 kilometers wide, and more than 2 million people live there. One of the most densely populated areas in the world, jam-packed, an open-air prison, a concentration camp, and huge bombs are dropping on this place. Dear listeners, when there's a fierce storm and there's a clap of thunder and lightning, your young ones run and cling to you, right? Right. Now imagine this in Gaza through the night. Through the whole night, and the child knows that he or she could die because some of their friends or relatives have died. What horror, what trauma they must be going through. Horror, horror, horror. Fear like you can't imagine, but take a moment to imagine it. Eh? Take a moment to imagine this. What's happening now is a repeat of the bombardment of Gaza in 2014. 2,200 Palestinians were killed in that attack, and the children have not recovered from that yet, from 2014. Let me read from an Al Jazeera report, and let me say this, that it was a very difficult article for me to read early this morning. Wallahi, I had to stop to wipe away the tears. Well, I hope I can get through it without getting all choked up, inshallah. Bear with me, Habibi, bear with me. Here we go. Children were among the most affected group in the 50-day onslaught. The Israeli army killed 500 children. The bombing campaign, which started in July and ended in late August 2014, caused outrage and spurred international protests as images of dead children flooded social media. The United Nations estimates that currently more than 300,000 children are in need of psychosocial support. 3 years after the war, Al Jazeera speaks to the families of three children who were psychologically affected after surviving attacks or by the death of their siblings, relatives and friends. Here's one, the first one. Amir Ibrahim Al-Raqib, 9 years old, from the refugee camp known as Khan Yunus. Every time Amir hears the sound of Israeli warplanes buzzing in the sky or the sound of thunder in winter or a loud bang, he rushes to his parents for protection. Last July, on the first night of Eid al-Fitr, an Israeli attack hit near Amir's house in the town of Bani Shohela in Khan Yunus in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. His uncle and two of his neighbors were killed in the attack. 37 others were injured, including Amir. First responders could not find Amir easily. They thought he was dead, but later found his body about 100 meters away, covered in sand. And this is what is said by his mother, Ibitsam. This is what she says. Amir suffered an injury to his skull and broken bones in his jaw. She then pointed to the shrapnel that injured Amir in different parts of his body, particularly his eyes and lungs. He lost one of his eyes, she continued in a muffled voice. On this article were pictures of this boy. I tell you, it's heartbreaking to see that. Since the war, Amir has become a permanent visitor to hospital. He endured a series of surgeries in both Israel and the West Bank and spent 6 months in the ICU, which forced him to leave school. Ibitsam, his mother, 38 years old, devoted her life to Amir. She left her newborn baby, who was born on the same day that Amir was injured, July 27, 2014, to be with Amir, who was transferred to a hospital in Israel 3 days after he was injured. Amir has steadily recovered from his wounds, the psychological impact of the war has continued to haunt him. He awakes throughout the night saying he had a nightmare and can only sleep when his parents are by his side. And his mother says, he takes his pillow and follows me. He puts his pillow on my lap and sleeps. If he wakes and does not find me or his father next to him, he begins to cry, searching for us. Zahia Al-Kara, a psychologist at the Gaza Community Mental Health Center, says the many lingering effects of the war continue to arouse memories ever present within the imagination of the children. She told Al Jazeera, the end of the war does not mean that children are safe. The permanent electricity cuts and the continuous hovering of Israeli planes, the media, and constant talk about a potential imminent war, Kara explains, lower the morale of children and cause them to continuously haunted by the trauma. To be continuously haunted by the trauma. Here's another child, Muntasar Bakar, 14 years old, from Gaza City. Muntasar Bakar sits in the TV room watching the kids' channel Space Toon on what the limited hours of electricity permit him. The picture of his brother, Zakaria, hangs high behind him, along with the pictures of his nephew and two of his cousins. At 11, Muntasar witnessed one of the most horrific scenes a minor can come across. In one of the most controversial Israeli attacks during the war, Muntasar and seven of his relatives and friends, mostly minors, became the target of Israeli missiles while they were playing football on the beach. Muntasar and three other children from his extended family managed to escape, wounded, but four others, including his brother, were killed in the attack. 3 days after the tragedy, Muntasar awoke from a coma and started shouting, "They're all dead! I killed them! I killed them!" He clung to his mother with both hands before she said, "You did not kill anyone." Ever since, Muntasar has suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. His days at school have become a distant dream. His mother said, while crying, he used to sit with his brother and they would go to school together, play together. Anyway, I'm going to leave this report now. It's just too horrific. Right. Let me move on a little bit. My dear listeners, when there is a thunderstorm, as I told you, and your children run to cling to you, it's only for a short while, maybe an hour or two, terrified. But the children of Gaza suffered the terror of thinking that they may die any minute. And that terror, that trauma stays with them for years after the bombs stop. It's a sin, eh? Someone gave Benjamin a new name, Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's some background. Israel does not have a government after the elections. Netanyahu is trying to get the smaller parties to join him so that he can get around 65 seats and form the new government. The small parties are all extremely right-wing parties, most of them who feel that the Palestinians shouldn't be there at all. So, taking action against Palestinians helps, especially if you provoke the Palestinians and they respond. And you have war. You saw what happened at Al-Aqsa. They say that the Palestinians were throwing rocks over the wall onto the people who were praying at the wailing. Well, I haven't seen any videos of that, frankly. Israel would have splashed it all over the place. I haven't seen rocks being thrown. And even if rocks were thrown, even if stones were thrown across the wall, must you rush in with your heavily armed troops, walk with boots and all in Al-Aqsa Mosque, in Al-Aqsa Masjid, shooting people, five people lost their eyes, just randomly start shooting everyone? Is that what this is all about? So, so taking action against Palestinians, as I said, helps, especially if you provoke the Palestinians and they respond. And you have war. War unites people, so he helps the Israeli public, especially the right wing, and they all get behind him and they join him. Right? He is desperate to be the prime minister again, so that he can be, so that he cannot be put on trial for the fraud and corruption charges that he faces. If he doesn't become prime minister, he will very likely have to face justice and probably jail. So crudely speaking, dead Palestinians could get him elected. But this whole issue currently started at Sheikh Jarrah with the threat of Palestinians being evicted from their homes. Israeli settler organizations say that the land on which the houses were built belongs to them. So the whole matter is in court. Well, let's look at it this way. If it's true that Jews once long ago owned the place, then okay, as a matter of principle, the Palestinians must leave. But hang on, if we look at the legal principle, at this legal principle, then the Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah must be given back their lands and homes from which they were chased out when Israel was created. And the this legal principle must also be applied to the people in Gaza, who are actually refugees who were chased out of their lands and homes when Israel was created. What about the 4 to 5 million Palestinians who were chased out and are now living in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan in 1947, 1948? Can anyone guess what day is today? Can you guess? Come on. Come on. Hey, hurry. We have little time. What great significant day is today for the Palestinian and his supporters? Yes, sis, you never cease to amaze me. You know that? May 15th, what day is it? It's Nakba Day. Yes, the most important day in the Palestinian calendar. Nakba, the great tragedy, the catastrophe. Israel was officially declared on the 14th of May, 1948. The next day, 15th of May, is known as Nakba Day. And in all the refugee, the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, etc., the Palestinians march and hold their hands up high. And what's in their hands? What's in their hands? The keys of the homes from which they were chased out in 1947 and 1948. Today is Nakba Day. So if the courts give back the homes in which the Palestinians are living to the Jews as a matter of legal principle, then logically the Jews living in the homes and lands that belong to the Palestinians must be given all back to the Palestinians. The 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, the 4 million refugees in Arab countries. Which brings to mind, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It stands for equal treatment, specifically against double standards and hypocrisy. But there's more than enough of it in Israel, which prides itself as a democracy and then says it's a Jewish state, ignoring the obvious contradiction. And still Israel paints itself as a victim of Palestinian terror And still in the West, the West believes that Israel is the victim. All you hear from Biden and his officials, and you know, I was quite surprised to hear Angela Merkel from Germany also to say this. Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel has a right to defend itself. Wonderful, isn't it? Right. The word is right. Well, what about the Palestinians? Does the word right apply to them? Or maybe it should be rights for the Palestinians. The rights to live in freedom and dignity. The right to be equal as human beings. The right to security. The right to live where they choose. The right to education. The right to freedom of movement. The right to access justice. The right to... the list is very long. But simply, the right to all the things that Israelis enjoy under the sun. And if all have equal rights, there's no need for war. Correct? No war. And so Israel won't need to defend itself if it gave the Palestinians all these rights. But you have to defend injustice with guns and tanks and fighter jets. Simple logic. And so we hear the same old mantra, Israel has a right to defend itself from Hamas rockets. Western media and politicians apply the anesthetic by saying this, and the people are numbed into agreement that Israel is the victim. Well, no time left at all. I hope that our guest, Reverend Ntutuko Nkosi, shone a spotlight on the situation in Palestine. Much more to speak about. Inshallah, we'll continue next week. This is A.B. Dawji. This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.